No, hold on a minute here. I got the wrong barnyard sound. That's it. It's supposed to be a turkey, anyway. I think I need some new sound clips. Well, here we are at Thanksgiving once again, ladies and gents. Prior to the barnyard sounds, you heard one of Haydn's Derbyshire marches. And this is your genial host, John Derbyshire, ready to span the world once again on Radio Derb. It's a bigger than usual Radio Derb this week to see you through the long holiday weekend. Not too big, I hope. Not too big to be allowed into New Zealand, anyway. I'll explain that in a moment. Meanwhile, if you're ready, grab a drumstick and a slice of pumpkin pie and settle down with Radio Derb. Listeners, I have come into possession of some knowledge that could turn this election campaign around. A source inside the Romney camp has told me that there are rumours going around in the Giuliani campaign that staffers at the Thompson headquarters are whispering that John McCain's people are murmuring that one of Mike Huckabee's key aides was overheard repeating certain startling speculations about what Tom Tancredo's people are saying about Ron Paul. Now, naturally, I'm not in a position to confirm or deny what my source told me about the rumours of the whispers of the murmurs concerning the hearsay about the speculations on the insinuations. All I can tell you is that when I called Duncan Hunter's people, they said, no comment. Which I think speaks volumes. An Englishman is never at home except when he's abroad, goes the old saying. Often misinterpreted by American ears to mean that we're only happy when we're mincing around in a blonde wig and a frilly dress, like a certain Republican presidential candidate. No, the meaning is that we descendants of Alfred the Great can't wait to get away from those misty islands to some place with a decent climate, modern plumbing, and good dental hygiene. Then we can sit around, moping nostalgically about the dear old homeland.
Home, home, sweet, sweet home.
Thank you. These fine traditions continue today, now much reinforced by strenuous efforts on the part of recent British governments to make their country uninhabitable. There have been several prongs to the strategy. Knowing that English people dislike foreigners, the British government has imported several million of the devils, with strong preference given to foreigners who reciprocate the dislike. Lest anyone should complain, hate speech laws have been enacted so that if you find that, for example, your child is the only one in her class at school whose native language is English, and should you have the temerity to complain about it, you will soon find yourself breaking rocks on the Yorkshire moors while wearing striped pyjamas. And then, to pay for all the education and health care of all those Urdu-speaking kids, plus social security for their unemployable grandparents, along with jail space for the Jamaican drug runners and the Romanian gypsy cut purses, should you be so foolish as to engage in full-time employment in order to pay for the aforementioned, you will be taxed until your eyeballs pop out and hang limply down your pale, pimply, sun-starved English cheeks. So, you leave, as I did. And as, according to Britain's Office of National Statistics, 207,000 other Brits did last year, the first year ever to record over 200,000 emigrants. Most of the Britons went to Australia, New Zealand, France, Spain, or the United States. Well, you know the old Bertolt Brecht quip about how the government, being dissatisfied with the people, has decided to elect a new people. In Britain, it's coming true. Thank goodness no such thing could ever happen in the USA. Mind you, and incredible as it seems to me, we Brits are not always given the welcome that we are rightfully entitled to, as sometimes civilizers of the whole world. Here's a very sad story from New Zealand. New Zealand, it says here, I'm reading from the November 20th Daily Telegraph, New Zealand is critically short of skilled workers, and many large firms are intensively recruiting in Britain. So far, so good. The kind of immigrant they're looking for would be somebody like Mr. Richie Trezice, a highly qualified specialist in undersea cable work. Being a long way from anywhere, New Zealand has lots of undersea cables to tend, and expertise in this area is in short supply. So, off goes Mr. Trezice, waving Shakespeare's island goodbye to settle down under among the Kiwis. Next thing, he naturally wants his wife to join him. Here, however, things went, as the British say, somewhat pear-shaped. To qualify as an immigrant into New Zealand, you see, your body mass index, your BMI, that's your weight divided by the square of your height, in kilograms and meters, please, your BMI has to fall within a certain range. If you're too thin or too fat, New Zealand won't let you in. The logic there is that too fat or too thin people are likely to be burdens on the health services. Mrs. Trezice is fat. She's not chubby, she's not well upholstered, she's not cuddly or zaftig, she's fat. Too fat to settle in New Zealand, say the authorities. None of the newspapers will tell us what Mrs. Trezice's weight actually is, nor even her BMI, for that matter. But it's obvious from the pictures that treadmills, stairmasters, and exercise bikes are not key appurtenances of Mrs. Trezice's lifestyle. Even Mr. Trezice himself had trouble passing the immigration test initially, having a BMI of 42. Which means, if you assume that he's the average British male height of 5'10", it means he was nudging 300 pounds. Mr. Trezice shaped up, however, and he has now been admitted as an immigrant to New Zealand. But poor Mrs. Trezice is still stuck firmly in New Zealand's front door. It's a sad story, but you know what? As unfair as New Zealand's immigration policies may be to fat people, at least they have immigration policies. I don't mean to imply that the USA doesn't have an immigration policy. Of course we have one. Our problem is not having an immigration policy. Our problem is that our immigration policy was written by the government of Mexico with the aim of shucking off their unemployment issues, their welfare costs, and their crime, race, education, and public health problems onto us. An illustration of this showed up last week, and I shall share it with you. Down on the Mexican border, the U.S. Border Patrol has conducted a 9-week project named Fence Lab. Fence Lab. No, not Dense Flab. That was the previous story. Pay attention there in the back row and spit out that gum. Thank you. Okay, Fence Lab. The objective here is to settle on a design for the border fence that our government is going to build any time now. Possibly next year, or maybe the year after, but they are absolutely determined to build it. Yes, sirree. Congress told them they must, so of course they will. just as soon as they get the design figured out, which, you know, could take some time. That's what this 9-week project, this fence lab, was all about, to settle on a design, or at least, you know, to get some preliminary ideas so that plans for a design could be begun to be discussed when the appropriate working committees can be assembled and funds appropriated for their salaries and expenses and clearance for their work got from the security agencies, the EEOC, the EPA, the Justice Department, the World Council of Churches, and so on. Yes, sir, this fence building is proceeding with all dispatch. No dragging of feet here. Absolutely not. Well, back to Fence Lab. What are the design constraints? Quote from the US government specs. Quote, the fence must be formidable, but not lethal. Visually imposing, but not ugly. Durable, but environmentally friendly. And economically built, but not flimsy. End quote. It has to be a nice fence, you see, because we are a nice country. Heaven forbid anyone should think we are not nice. If anyone were to think that, why, we'd just shrivel up and die, whimpering quietly as we went. By the time they've got that design award fence erected, possibly after consulting with Tommy Hilfiger, Vera Wang, Guy LaRoss, and the Versace family, it may no longer be necessary. An analysis just released by the Census Bureau shows the frequency of various surnames in the United States and compares the frequencies in 1990 with those of 10 years later. Guess what? The top 10 surnames in the year 2000 included 2 Hispanic names, Garcia and Rodriguez, for the first time ever. It is, in fact, the first time ever that any non-Anglo names have shown up in the top 10. What do people think about that? Well, here's Mr. Luis Padilla, a 48-year-old banker from Colombia, now living in Miami, quoted in the New York Times story I'm reading. Quote, it shows we're getting stronger. If there's that many of us to outnumber the Anglo names, it's a great thing. End quote. Okay, but who is we in that sentence, Mr. Padilla? We bankers? We people from Miami? We Padillas? We 48-year-olds? The Times story gives no clue, and I'm darned if I can figure it out. Another person quoted in the Times story was Reinaldo Valdez, a board member of the Miami-based Spanish-American League Against Discrimination, which as an acronym I couldn't help noticing works out as SALAD, which is very nearly the Spanish word for salty. Make of that what you will. Anyway, here's what Mr. Valdez had to say. Quote, this gives the Hispanic community a standing within the social structure of the country. End quote. Well, what can one say? Speaking as a proud member of the cranky, uptight, old Anglo white guy community, I welcome our new overlords, whatever their body mass index may be. Al Gore has so many awards now, his office there at Current TV must look like Tiger Woods' den. Well, now Al's got another one. The doom-monger-in-chief got an honorary award at the International Emmys this week. Quote, in recognition of his work in broadcasting. Just to give you a clue what kind of zone we're in here, another one of the award winners was British TV channel More Four's programme Death of a President, which opens with the fictional assassination of George W. Bush. I bet it's one of Al's favourites, when he's not bloviating about the climate, that is. Quote from Al on receiving the award, quote, "The climate crisis is by far the most serious challenge human civilization has ever faced. But this great powerful medium of television can be part of that solution, because networks and channels all around the world represented here can help to get the word out while there is still time." End quote. Salvation by television, you see? Oh yes, that'll work. All you have to do is get a couple of billion people to switch channels from Desperate Housewives, the NASCAR special, SpongeBob SquarePants, Monday Night Football, and whatever the favourite show is in the Muslim world, something like Killing Jews and Christians for Fun and Profit, something like that, I would imagine, to get them to switch from those to one of Al Gore's award-winning Boreathons. After the award ceremony, the international stars of politically correct TV flew home in their private jets to their 100,000-square-foot air-conditioned chateaus to watch Al Gore's latest documentary about CO2 reduction. More here on TV, and in fact more on the British government's campaign to drive British people out of their country. Back in January this year, a British TV station aired a programme named Undercover Mosque. They sent a reporter into various mosques in the West Midlands city of Birmingham, where my Aunt Muriel lives. Hello, Auntie Moo. To secretly record what the Muslim preachers were telling their flocks. What were they telling them? Well, here are some samples. Sample. By the age of 10, it becomes an obligation on us to force young girls to wear hijab. And if she doesn't wear hijab, we hit her. That's the first sample. The hijab is that headscarf thing that Muslim women are supposed to wear so that good Muslim males won't be driven into an uncontrollable frenzy of lust by the sight of a girl's hair. Here's another sample. Take that homosexual and throw him off the mountain. Now, since the English West Midlands are as flat as a pancake, it's a bit hard to see how the faithful are going to carry out this injunction, but perhaps it's just symbolic, I don't know. Another sample. Whoever changes his religion from Al-Islam to anything else, kill him in the Islamic State. And I'm sure likewise with anyone who changes his TV channel from Al Gore. Yet another sample. There will be a House of Commons, but they will decide every issue in accordance with the Book of Allah and the example of the Prophet. Well, they're pretty much doing that already, I think, aren't they? One final sample of British mosque instruction. The time is fast approaching when the tables are going to turn and the Muslims are going to be in a position of being uppermost in strength. Wow. Sounds like that guy in Miami. Well, as I said, all this was revealed to British TV viewers on this programme called Undercover Mosque. Now, naturally, the authorities quickly swung into action. The West Midlands Police Force, in response to many complaints, held a 7-month inquiry. At the end of that inquiry, the bobbies referred the offending parties to a regulatory authority named Ofcom. What does Ofcom regulate? Why, they regulate TV producers. Who, in the minds of the West Midlands Police, were the offending parties? The TV producers who made the programme. What offence did the police believe that the programme makers were guilty of? Quote, undermining community cohesion. And whose numerous complaints were the police responding to? Well, the complaints of local Muslims, of course. What on earth did you think? That local English people would complain? No, sir. The local English are too busy puffing their way through leg lifts and ab crunches, trying to lose weight so they can emigrate to New Zealand. The saga of Jihad Jane continues, offering ever more insights into the wonderful vigilance and effectiveness of the $100 billion federal agencies charged with keeping foreign criminals and terrorists out of our country. Jihad Jane, you recall, is the Lebanese lady. Her real name is Nadia Nadim Prouty, who overstayed her visa back in 1989, contracted a sham marriage to get US citizenship, and then went to work for the FBI and CIA, whose computers she hacked into on behalf of Hezbollah, with whose leaders she is friendly. Well, now our terrific, super-efficient security and immigration services are doing background checks on Miss Prouty. This is a tad late, but heck, these are busy people, you know. They have that fence to design, and, border patrol agents to prosecute, and all sorts of stuff. Well, their checks have turned up some interesting stuff. Miss Prouty belongs to the Lebanese Al-Awar clan, known over there as a pillar of the Syrian National Socialist Party. That's Syrian, as in pawn of Syria, and National Socialist, as in, well, National Socialist. Furthermore, Ms. Prouty, née Al-Awar, has a cousin, Nidal Al-Awar, who is a major lifelong terrorist, trained in North Korea and the old USSR. Not only are all these things so, but everybody in Lebanon knows they are so. As they say in Ireland, even the dogs in the street know. Meanwhile, here in the USA, Ms. Prouty's brother-in-law, Talal Chahine, is a crook who operates an immigration fraud ring over in Michigan, and also a money laundering operation on behalf of Hezbollah. This has been known for years. The feds have actually been investigating the guy since 2003. Probably the dogs in the streets of Michigan know it. Oh, did I mention that Miss Prouty's sister is an employee of the State Department? Very likely even the dogs in Foggy Bottom know about her. And now we all know these things too, thanks to the diligent inquiries of the FBI, the CIA, and the Homeland Security Department. What a pity those inquiries come 18 years too late. Tyler Cohen is an economist, one of the two who run the free market economics blog called Marginal Revolution. Tyler wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post last Sunday, spelling out just what a disaster for our country the Iraq War has been. Like me, Cohen started off supporting the Iraq invasion. Like me, he is now sadder and wiser, and dismayed at the negative consequences of this war. There are, for one thing, the sheer financial costs. At least $1 trillion, possibly 1.3 trillion. That would be somewhere well north of $4,000 for every man, woman, and child of us. Close to $20,000 for my little family of four. Then there are the human costs. Nearly 4,000 of our troops killed and 28,000 wounded, along with 1,000 civilian contractors killed, and some unknown number of Iraqis. That's pretty straightforward. Then Cohen talks about opportunity costs, hidden costs. Opportunity cost is a term of art in economics. If you decide to do A instead of B or C or D, the opportunity cost of doing A is whichever of B, C or D would have yielded the most value. A was worth doing if it yields more value than the opportunity costs. What have been the opportunity costs of the Iraq War? Cohen spells them out. We still haven't secured our ports against nuclear terrorism. $1 trillion would have funded the Homeland Security Department 28 times over. We've done next to nothing to prevent terrorists and their helpers from sneaking into our country, as the Jihad Jane episode shows. A failed war makes it harder, and you can read more expensive for that, to recruit and train quality troops and National Guard personnel. It makes it harder to get public support for any use of the military. It emboldens our enemies and reinforces their belief that their best hope for security is in getting nuclear weapons, ASAP, thus speeding nuclear proliferation. Quote from Cohen: "The projection of American power and influence in the future requires that an impatient public feel good about American muscle flexing in the past. Since turning tail hurts our credibility so badly and leaves such a mess behind, we should be extremely cautious about military intervention in the first place. The case for hawkish behaviour often assumes that the public has more political will than it actually has, so we need to save up that resolve for cases when it really counts." End quote. It didn't really count in Iraq. We know that now. Cue Mr. Kipling, the greatest of all patriotic poets. "Let us admit it fairly. As a business people should. We have had no end of a lesson. It will do us no end of good." I really hope it will, for our country's sake. Here is a miscellany of short items to see us out. Item: happy anniversary to Betty and Phil Windsor over there in Buckingham Palace. Married 60 years ago this week. Phil's looking a bit the worse for wear, but Betty's going strong. Why not? Her mum lived to be 101, though it's true that she had an assist from the life-prolonging benefits of gin, while Betty is a teetotaler. Still, Charles needn't be in any hurry trying on the crown for size. By the time he gets to be king, the place will be an Islamic republic anyway, with a bunch of mullahs in charge. Item: here in New York's Suffolk County, the local DMV is demanding that a guy return his vanity license plates. The plates bear the letters G-E-T-O-S-A-M-A. That spells Get Osama. Bad, says the DMV, which has a rule that plates must not be, quote, obscene, lewd, lascivious, derogatory to a particular ethnic or other group, or patently offensive. The DMV has not told us which of those categories Get Osama falls into. No sign yet that they're coming after me for my Get Spitzer license plates. Item: the president has carried out the pardoning of the traditional Thanksgiving turkey. I'm sure he'd like to pardon Border Patrol agents Ignacio Ramos and Jose Compian too, especially now that the guy whose testimony put them behind bars has been arrested for drug smuggling after being tricked back into the USA. However much our president might like to pardon Ramos and Compian, though, his boss in Mexico City isn't going to let him. Item, you ever notice how some stories just disappear without trace? Remember the Columbia University noose incident? 6 weeks ago, Madonna Constantine, a black professor at the teacher's school, found a noose on her office door. The police investigated. They took all the campus surveillance tapes, though Columbia put up a fight about releasing those tapes and the police had to threaten a subpoena. The police were also said to be running DNA tests on the noose itself. This story was all over our newspapers and TVs. But yes, that was 6 weeks ago. Since then, nothing. Not a peep. And no visible interest at all among our media people in finding out what, if anything, the police have turned up from all these weeks of investigating and testing. Funny, isn't it? I'm sure the culprit will soon be identified, though. Any day now, I'm sure. Item. More news from the Academy. Carol Simpson, a former ABC News anchor, now a professor of journalism at Emerson College in Boston, Mass., publicly endorsed Hillary Clinton for president at a rally in New Hampshire. Gushed this professor of the journalistic arts, "I want to tell you tonight, because I happen to be here with my students, that I endorse you for President of the United States. I wanted you to know that I think you are the woman, and I think this is the time." Well, it's nice to know that Professor Simpson's students were with her to get a direct lesson in journalistic objectivity. Meanwhile, back at Columbia, if you can make your way through the throngs of police and detectives still trying to fathom that noose incident of 6 weeks ago, you will find Joseph Massad being considered for tenure as a professor of modern Arab politics. Massad teaches his students, inter alia, that Israel poisoned Yasser Arafat, that Palestinians who criticize Hamas are tools of Israel, and that Zionism gets its name from a Hebrew slang word for penis. The only book on Israel that Mr. Massad has ever been known to assign his students was written by a French Marxist and has the title Israel, a Colonial Settler State. Tenure? I would say this guy's a shoo-in. Item. The United Nations IPCC, that's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has issued its final report. The report has lots of lurid warnings, but it ranks them by probability, the most lurid being the least probable. Worst case, which is actually not very probable, a 6-degree warming by 2030, and extinction of a third of all plant and animal species. Will that include turkeys? They don't say. So there you have it. A note of gloom there to sign off with. But don't let it put you off your Thanksgiving dinner. It certainly won't put me off mine. I suspect turkeys will be around for a while yet. We've certainly got a nice plump one to look forward to, so we're thankful for that. I just checked my body mass index. It came out at a pretty exact 25, which is not bad. I aim to raise it a couple of points over the Thanksgiving holiday. We're thankful for much else, too. We're thankful for our health, for our kids, for our friends, for our pleasant middle-class lifestyle, for having got out of our countries and being taken in by good old Uncle Sam, for single malt scotch, almond cookies, the operas of Bellini, and much more. I wish you all warm joy at your own festivities, united with your families in love and harmony. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting National Review, and a very pleasant holiday to all of you.